Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the national security and foreign policies of President Kennedy, which President Johnson thus far seems to have made his own, rest upon twin assumptions, namely, first, that the danger of nuclear war, by accident or inadvertence, should be the principal concern of American statecraft, and secondly, that a nuclear detente between the United States and the Soviet Union can be negotiated without detriment to the Western alliance. Neither President Kennedy nor President Johnson have ever stated these assumptions explicitly, although President Kennedy's celebrated speech on June 10, 1963, at the American University, calling for a reorientation of American foreign policy, allows for no other interpretation of American official thought. Explicitly stated or not, the assumptions underlying United States foreign policy can be inferred quite easily from a number of policy statements on U.S. military defense and U.S.-Soviet relationships, and more importantly, from policy decisions such as, for example, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the proposal for a multilateral force, and the redeployment of land-based nuclear weapons in Europe. Thus, the overarching goal of the administration seems to be to conclude with the Soviet Union arms limitation agreement and ultimately disarmament agreements, which will inhibit what is called the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the rise of nth nuclear powers. Along the way, Europe is to be transformed into a denuclearized zone, the United States and the Soviet Union remaining the sole possessors of nuclear power, China's nascent nuclear power having been eliminated, if need be, by surgery. The question having been thus simplified, it is expected that the United States and the Soviet Union, by symmetric moves, will divest themselves of all or part of their nuclear power and settle down to a state of global stability, a condominium for the preservation of world peace. If this is not the meaning of the administration's foreign policy, then indeed its foreign policy is a child's tale told by an idiot. The first and sufficient reasons for rejecting the assumptions underlying the administration's foreign policy is their inconsistency with fact and principle. This side of surrender, accommodation with the communist system is impossible. A compromise with the communist system compromises the cause of freedom everywhere, on this and the other side of the Iron Curtain. The Cold War will not simply end because we have decided not to fight it. The communist system is a conflict system. Its ideology is an ideology of war. Communist leadership cannot cut the umbilical cord which joins its power to the ideology which sanctions its authority. The Soviet Communist Party is a priestly class which owes its very existence to its exclusive possession of the sacred truth. Rightly, the priests resisted Khrushchev's attempt to divert them from priestly to secular duties. The principal role of a priesthood, justifying its demands upon the faithful, is the interpretation and administration of mysteries. The innermost mystery of communism is the unceasing struggle between classes, between imperialist states, and between imperialism and communism. Were the communist hierarchy to disown this dogma, it would not only deny the faith, but more important still, also kill the faith of the faithful. Never in history has a priestly class committed such suicidal folly. Now it is possible, though unlikely, that the communist leaders will depose one another until no one is left to minister the communist faith. But it is difficult to perceive how the West's accommodation of Soviet foreign policy can precipitate or hasten such a self-destructive process. If the communist system is bent upon destroying itself, it will do so for reasons inherent in it. It ill behooves the outsider to interfere with the process. The best he can do is to do nothing. The idea of an internal beneficial evolution of the communist system is characteristically a Western idea, fostered by the West's gradualist approach to social development and constitutional change. Violent change is the only kind of change known to the communist system historically and philosophically. Closely akin to the notion of the communist system's capacity for gradual, beneficent change is the idea of the revolutionary fatigue which, so it is alleged, has befallen the ruling elite of the communist states in Europe. It was Arnold Toynbee who first served up this hoary chestnut. Indeed, militant Islam and crusading Christianity lost their élan vital. They did so after several hundreds of years of bloody struggle. All available empirical evidence suggests that in the Soviet Union, ceaseless and intensive indoctrination has molded the mind of the Soviet population so that, at the discretion of the rulers, the masses can be made to do or die for the glory of the great communist system. Indeed, it would be surprising if it were otherwise, for the expansion of the last 47 years of the communist system throughout the world is the greatest success story in history. Not all champions of an accommodationist policy towards the Soviet Union put their money on the convergence, the halfway meeting, of communist and Western social evolution, or upon the withering away of the communist revolutionary zeal. The pragmatically minded suggest the teaming up of the Soviet Union and the United States in great undertakings on behalf of human betterment. They propose that in technological comradeship, we launch weather satellites, explore space, and desalinate salt water. Since such enterprises are unlikely to stir popular enthusiasm, the proponents of functional togetherness hint at some more exhilarating adventures in political cooperation. In order to banish the dread specter of nuclear proliferation, the Soviets and we should agree upon disarming the would-be nuclear powers of tomorrow, notably Red China and France. This type of American-Soviet cooperation would be enlivened by that sense of urgency which only a common enemy evokes. If a plausible common enemy does not exist, then he has to be contrived. One promising prospect is revanchist Germany. Germany is now a faithful ally of the West, but the Germans might soon revert again to their congenital aggressiveness. So why not agree beforehand on scotching the predatory instincts hidden in the Teutonic breast? What better is there, what better way is there to make absolutely sure about the future and at the same time doing constructive work in common than to transform Germany and, for good measure, the rest of continental Western Europe into a demilitarized zone? The drums are beating for a European settlement, a more sophisticated, a political-military Morgenthau plan. Not so surprisingly, some of the most vocal among the advocates of this solution insist that military technological breakthroughs can no longer upset the power balance between the Soviets and us, and that therefore we might just as well stop trying for significant improvements in weaponry. Having satisfied themselves that military technology has reached the plateau of overkill and cannot rise above it, they suggest that we should settle for stability, namely the present stalemate. The history of war, from Cressy to Hiroshima, tells a somewhat different story. Be that as it may, the scientific theorists of overkill are not impressed by this kind of empirical evidence. They rest their facts firmly upon their conclusions. Suffice to say that nuclear warheads are only one part of the nuclear strategic equation, that nuclear war is only one aspect of modern warfare, and that strategic superiority is a mix of all kinds of weapon systems and political spatial factors. Not so surprisingly, the men in the Kremlin do not take vigorous issue with the various accommodationist doctrines which now are achieving wide popularity in the West and appear to sway the West's most powerful statesmen. To the contrary, a procession of Soviet scientists, scholars, and journalists, gathering at meetings in a variety of more or less comfortable places, confide to their Western opposites their concern about the dangers of nuclear war, the menace of nuclear proliferation, the peril of German revanchism, and, sotto voce, the awesome specter of yellow hordes on the march. Such warm intimacies engender pleasant feelings. The great thaw now melts the icicles of the Cold War. Beyond a shadow of doubt, the communist system stands in need of a period of rehabilitation. After Cuba and the Soviet agricultural crisis, a complex and costly job of reconsolidation and realignment has to be done. The frontal assault against the NATO fortress has been discouraged. The prosperity of Europe has repulsed the attempt at wholesale communist subversion. In the 1930s, an adverse power balance counseled the Soviets to fall back on the safer tactic of political warfare, namely the tactics of the Popular Front and the Trojan Horse. By one of those classic inversions of their doctrine which mark a tactical shift, the communists now move to the side of gradual social reform, removing the compromising label of monolithic leadership in the Kremlin. The European communist parties now rediscover, now avow, exactly as they did in the 1930s, their devotion to their respective host countries' best national interests, the Popular Front restored. The overarching fact of the 60s is the crisis of the Western Alliance. The roots of this crisis are many. The deepest is the ambiguity of American foreign policy, a foreign policy uncertain about world political priorities. What is the first thing that must come first? The detente with the communists or strengthening the Atlantic Alliance? America's retention of control over NATO's nuclear might or the modernization of NATO's military forces? The insulation of United States' strategy against the counsel and influence of its allies, or the making of an Atlantic Confederation? None of these questions have been answered. The alternatives are sharply drawn. They are not necessarily mutually exclusive. They cannot be pursued all at once with the same purposefulness. A hierarchy of goals need be established, lest America's involvement in world politics culminate in isolation, an isolation by inadvertence far more confining than its historical model. Since 1949, NATO has undergone changes, many changes. One thing about NATO has not changed. It is marked out for destruction by Soviet strategy. The sum and substance of Soviet strategy is to divide Western Europe from America and thus to isolate the United States, to draw the United States away from its European commitments, and to divide Western Europeans from each other and from the United States, to involve the United States in Asian wars and thus to sap American resources and to entrap the United States in the role of imperialist aggressor. These were, are, and will be the principal purposes of Soviet strategy. In these endeavors, the Soviets have been most effectively assisted by the short attention span of the West. The design is so plain that only the West's sophisticates, who know everything and understand nothing, cannot see it. What the United States should do in order to extricate itself from the dilemma of its own making and thwart Soviet purpose, this too is plain. Instead of pursuing the phantom of peaceful coexistence with communism, the United States should make sure it keeps what it possesses, namely the solidarity, severely tried yet still unbroken, of the West. Together with our own strength, the Atlantic Alliance distills the greatest asset in our ledger. Beyond a shadow of doubt, the great majority of Americans crave peace and plenty. Most of us like to concentrate our energies upon making ourselves more comfortable, with edifying leisure on our hands in the great futurized society of sweetly purring computers. As things stand now, we still have unsettled business on our hands, namely how to ensure the West's and our own survival against unreconstructed communism. We are now passing through a period of uncertain truths. The opponent is regrouping his forces. Sooner than we may think, another round of protracted conflict may begin. The only question now is this: will we be as lucky as we were in Cuba, when next we meet the ineluctable challenge of communist power? The world balance of power is a dynamic thing. It cannot be stabilized, for instability is the nature of the communist system. In times gone by, we could rely upon events to arouse us from our world political euphoria. We managed to survive Pearl Harbor. In Cuba, by a narrow shave and much later than was necessary, we avoided disaster. It is doubtful that twice in a generation we will be given sufficient warning time to pull ourselves together. We must snap out of our reverie. We dare no longer gamble upon the miscalculations of the enemy. Long ago, the clang of church bells aroused the populace and alerted it to disaster. In this day, our own intelligence, and only our own intelligence, can alert us. The odds that we, the spoiled children of history, can accomplish such a feat of anticipation are forbidding. Certainly, the lack of inspired leadership will reduce our chances to nil. President Johnson carries a heavier burden than any American president before him. Upon his informed will hinges the future, not only of this country, but also of Western civilization. I thank you.